time, right before my eyes. If I'd known, I would never have let them... He trailed off, his jaw clenched. She wanted so badly to touch him. I know, she told him instead. You were marvelous out there, during the race. I've never seen that kind of power. Riel, it was beautiful. She could not help but flush with pleasure, despite everything. They were going to kill you. I couldn't let that happen. He raised an eyebrow. And I cannot take care of myself. You can, and you did. But... She fell silent, swallowing her voice. But if you had died, I couldn't have borne it. If you had died, I don't know what would have happened next. What I would have done to avenge you. Audric cleared his throat. He seemed to choose his words carefully. When I saw you riding toward me, I didn't know that the blood was from your horse. I thought it was yours. You were covered in it. And I thought... He walked toward her, his gaze lingering on her face, and then looked away. His presence was like a touch hovering just above her skin. Riel wanted desperately to lean into it, bask in it, claim it. You could say, thank you, she finally managed to say. At the very least. If you promise you won't terrify me like that again, or at least give me warning so I can prepare myself.
Of course, she agreed. If you warn me the next time you plan on getting yourself attacked by assassins.
He grinned at her. We did fight well together. I wouldn't mind doing it again. Then his expression softened. Thank you, Riel. She hoped he could not read her face.
What happens now?
That's what I've come to tell you. Audric began, and then the door opened, admitting Ludovine and the guards.
Did you tell her? She asked, looking troubled. What is it?
Riel said.
What have they decided?
They're requesting you come back inside at once, Lady Riel, said one of the guards.
Tell my uncle the king that she will attend him momentarily, Ludovine said, her sweet smile not reaching her eyes. And if he protests, then you may tell him to bite his tongue, or else his niece will hate him for the rest of his days.
The guard flushed and bowed his head, then retreated into the hall.
Many in the councils are afraid, Ludovine told Riel quickly, and the king is under tremendous pressure to act before rumors start spiraling out of control and spark a panic. Before, she paused, before anything else happens.
Before I lose control again, Riel thought grimly.
He would not have agreed to this unless he had no other choice, Ludovine continued.
Riel's stomach dropped.
Agreed to what?
7 trials, Ludovine explained.
1 for each element.
Tests of your power, Audric added. Engineered by the Magisterial Council, to ensure you can control your abilities.
He looked away, his mouth twisting bitterly.
Ludovine placed a gentle hand on his arm. They will not only be testing your control, they will also be testing your loyalty. You must not waver in this, Riel. 1 hint of defiance, 1 glimmer of treachery. What is it, exactly, that they think I'm going to do?
Riel burst out, an edge of incredulous laughter in her voice.
Defect to Borsval! Turn around in the middle of a trial and murder the king where he stands. We don't know what the Blood Queen will do when she arrives, Ludovine continued gently. 1 with the power to save the world, 1 with the power to destroy it, 1 of blood, 1 of light. I'm already tired of hearing that damned prophecy, Riel muttered, and was gratified to see Audric's tiny smile. The point is, Ludovine pressed on, that the councils believe you to be one of the queens, and if they can ensure that you are loyal, that you want only to protect Seldaria, and not destroy it. Riel threw up her hands. But why in God's name would I ever want to? Then this will signify to them, Ludovine said, talking over her, that whatever the prophecy says, you have made a choice. To protect and not harm, to serve and not betray. And if I choose not to participate in these trials? Riel asked, once she had found her voice again. Then, said Ludovine quietly, they will have no choice but to consider you a threat. Riel stepped back. A cold, sick feeling wound its way through her. They will kill me.
Not as long as I draw breath, Audric said, his fists clenched. I beg your pardon, my lord, the first guard muttered, uneasily entering the room. But I delivered Lady Ludovine's message to the king, and he requests... The look Audric threw him was murder. I know very well what the king requests.
When he at last turned back to Riel, his gaze was steady.
I won't allow anyone to harm you. You'll conquer these trials, and once you've convinced everyone,
then I will serve the crown. Riel finished for him.
Everyone knew the Sun Queen, if she ever arrived, would serve at the pleasure of Seldaria's rulers. She would lead the kingdom's armies into battle. Using her power, she would protect the country, protect the gate, protect the king.
Then you will serve the crown, Audric agreed.
Someday, he meant, she would serve him and his queen. She looked to Ludovine, and then away.
My lord, urged the guard from the door.
I'm ready,
Riel said, before Audric could threaten the man further, and led the way back into the hall. She stood once again before the dais as the councils shifted and settled above her. Her mind danced around the question.
How am I feeling right now? I have just been threatened with death.
She recognized she should probably be more upset, but it was all such a wild shift from what her life had been only 2 days before that she simply felt numb.
I will be tested, she thought. It will probably hurt.
Then, slowly trying out the idea,
I will show them what I can do. She considered it.
To be sought after instead of hidden away. To protect her country instead of living in fear that she was capable of nothing but hurting people. To be loved instead of hated. Tears stung her eyes.
I will be loved.
She found her father, surrounded by guards, standing expressionlessly beneath the statue of Saint Grimwald, a metal master, just as he was. She wondered what he was thinking, all his and Tal's careful work brought to ruin. And now the future, hers and theirs, lay in her hands, alone. She made herself stand tall.
They will love me. All of them will.
Riel listened as King Bastian repeated what Ludovine and Audric had told her. 7 trials, 1 for each of the 7 elements, to be designed by the Magisterial Council and administered to her over the next 7 weeks. If, by the end of that time, she had proven her abilities and her control to a satisfactory degree, if she had throughout the trials consistently demonstrated loyalty and devotion to the crown, and neither defiance nor volatility, then she would be deemed the Sun Queen, the most holy symbol of the Church and the prophesied protector of the crown, and would be accorded all due privileges and tributes. If not...
Then, Lady Riel, said the king, his voice heavy, I will have no choice but to order your execution.
Riel allowed the hall's silence to grow. Lord Dervin Savillier watched her, his eyes keen. Across the gallery from him, the Archon sat, sedate, with his hands folded in his lap.
"I do not decree this lightly," added the king. "I have known you all your life, and your father has served me for twice that long. But I cannot allow that to affect my duty to protect my people. We must be certain you are not the danger we have feared for 1,000 years.
"Oh, Riel," said the voice, returning with a swift jolt of anger. "Please tell me you won't let them trap you like this." But she had already stepped forward to speak. She felt as bright and sure as the sun. The magisterial council believed it to be a choice, Ludovine had said, to protect and not harm, to serve and not betray. It was a choice, and she had made hers. She would be a symbol of light, and not of death.
"I understand your fear, my king," said Riel, "and I will happily endure these trials to prove my worth and my strength to you, my people, and my country."
She made herself look around the room. No one would be able to accuse her of cowardice. She found Audric and Ludovine, drew strength from the sight of their faces.
"I am not afraid to test my power."
Whispers moved through the assembled councils. Riel lifted her chin to stare up at the king.
"I will show you what I can do. I will show you who I truly am."
"Then, Lady Riel,"
said the king at last, his expression torn,
"let the trials begin."
Chapter 12. Eliana. You will hear things about the Emperor's assassins, things designed to terrify you, that their loyalty to him gives them extraordinary strength, that, like him, they cannot be killed. But I tell you, the butchers of Invictus are as flesh and blood as you are. It is a battle of beliefs. Can your faith outlast theirs? The word of the prophet.
"You don't look surprised to see me," said Razavel.
He approached through the bathing room with a dancer's grace.
"So you're a fool, but you're not stupid."
Every instinct screamed at Eliana to run out of the maiden's fold after Simon and Navi. But to where? And then what? Razavel would chase her to the ends of the earth. He and Invictus and the Emperor himself would view her defection as a personal insult. She had time for two fleeting hopes, that Simon and Navi would get out of the palace safely, and that Simon would find a spark of mercy in his heart and protect Remy and Harkon. Then, Razavel attacked. He was fast, through the bathing room and upon her before she had the chance to strategize. He raised his sword, and with that pale face smiling coldly at her, everything Eliana knew abandoned her in an instant. She turned and ran. Razavel chased her through the scented labyrinth of the maiden's fold. He caught up with her, let his sword fly. Eliana swung the Adatrox sword, its heavy hilt slick with blood, and parried. Razavel advanced. Eliana barely blocked each of his cuts. Their blades caught. Eliana stepped back and quickly turned her sword, dislodging him. She swiped wildly at his torso, but he was too quick. He advanced again. Eliana stumbled back, found a carving of a scantily clad woman on a tabletop, threw it at him, and ran. She heard the carving hit the floor. Razavel's quick footsteps followed her through a series of narrow, carpeted rooms. Her strikes became desperate. Razavel was too fast, too meticulous. She gasped for breath, He hardly seemed to break a sweat. She ducked his sword, the blade hissing past her neck. She flung aside the Adatroc sword, used her free hand to grab whatever she could find. Vases, goblets, gilded plates, and fling them back at him. He laughed at her, dodging it all. They emerged once more into the bathing room, the tiles slick from water and blood. A lone girl huddled in the corner, whimpering. Roosevelt's smile unfolded.
"You're frightening the whores, Eliana."
She thrust at his belly with Arabeth. He blocked her easily. They circled each other, Eliana blinking back sweat. Her hair had fallen loose from its knot.
"You should never have turned," said Razavel, every syllable pristine. "You could have been one of the Emperor's favored. Your family would have wanted for nothing."
Then, without warning, someone shoved Eliana from behind. She lost her footing on the slick tile, and Razavel used his sword to knock Arabeth away. He lobbed a hard backhand across her face. She fell, her head knocking against a low table. Dazed, she saw movement and color. One of Lord Arkellion's concubines scurrying away. The girl had pushed her.
"It seems the bonds of sisterhood do not extend to traitors," Roosevelt's voice floated above her.
He straddled her hips, his face inches from her own. Clean, shaven jaw, straight nose, gray eyes flat and distant. She felt a sharp pain below her throat and glanced down, too dazed to fight. He was cutting her. A new panic seized her, shocking her awake. She needed to get away from him, now, before he saw the truth.
"Many would kill their dearest loved ones," Razavel murmured, "for the chance to serve the Emperor, as we do in Invictus. And yet, you have thrown in your lot with the Prophet's lapdog."
Another cut, a shallow X between her collarbones. She twisted in his grip. He cut into the soft flesh of her upper arm.
"God, no! He'll see!"
"I suppose I shall have to find the Emperor a more grateful recruit," he mused softly, "and keep you for myself."
He swirled one long finger in her fresh blood and dragged it down her arm to her elbow. He glanced down and froze. Eliana followed his gaze. The world slowed and stilled. Together, they watched the cut on her arm close. An instant later, the skin was as good as new. Razavel's gaze shot back to hers, and for the first time since she had known him, she saw a spark of something other than bloodlust in his eyes. Wonder, confusion, fear. Eliana could hardly breathe. Her blood raced hot beneath her skin.
"What are you?" Razavel whispered.
A sudden movement just beyond Razavel's shoulder. A tall, dark shape. A shift in the air. Eliana flashed Razavel a smile.
"I am your doom."
Razavel leapt up, turned, and met Simon's sword with his own. Eliana rolled away, retrieved Arabeth, and pushed herself to her feet, ready to jump in after Simon and help. But the sight of them stopped her in her tracks. Razavel and Simon whirled, stabbed, struck, their blades cutting the air. They swerved and ducked and parried and thrust. Whoever the Prophet was, he had obviously made sure Simon was well-trained enough to fight even the Emperor's own assassins. She followed them into the expansive sitting room at the rear of the Maiden's Fold, unsure how to help. Her vision had cleared. But Simon and Razavel were moving so quickly, it seemed to her simply elegant chaos. Daggers and swords, crimson and silver, the blood on the floor, and the blood-red wings of Razavel's cloak. Their fight took them onto the terrace surrounding the Maiden's Fold. Eliana hurried after them, the warm coastal breeze washing over her. Below, one of the river's tributaries crawled slowly to the sea. Razavel's blade caught Simon's, pinning him against the stone railing. They were locked together, Simon's eyes full of cold fury, Razavel's empty and deadly. Simon's knees were buckling. Eliana saw her opportunity, dove for Razavel's back with her dagger. He whirled at the last moment, knocked both her weapon and then Simon's out of their hands. Eliana grabbed a porcelain urn from a nearby table, brought it crashing down on Razavel's shoulders. He barely stumbled, but it was enough. Simon kicked Razavel's elbow, and the assassin dropped his sword. Then Simon shoved him across the terrace railing. Kicking and clawing, Razavel jabbed Simon in the throat, but Simon held on, gasping for air. Eliana hurried to his side, helped him push. Razavel tumbled over the railing and fell into the blackness below. Eliana gazed over the edge, trying to see if he hit the river, but the night was too dark. She wiped blood from her face, breathing hard. Simon joined her, coughing from Razavel's last blow to the throat. He spat over the railing, his lip curled with disgust.
"Do you think the fool was enough to kill him?"
the girl, Navi, asked, joining them at the railing. Then the bells of the watchtowers along the palace walls began to ring. Navi hissed a curse.
"Razia! She disappeared shortly after you arrived. She must have reported you."
Eliana's eyes met Simon's.
"Follow me. We'll have to do this the hard way."
She led him and Navi back through the palace, down a different network of narrow servants' passages. They met three Adatrochs coming up from the ballrooms. Navi flattened herself against the curving stone wall, while Eliana and Simon punched and stabbed their way free. They dashed inside a suite of rooms in the palace's east wing, where party guests occupying the bedrooms shouted in protest, then raced out onto another wide terrace, this one lit with rose-glass lamps and fragrant from heaps of flowers. Below, Lord Arkelian's gardens were a sea of light and color. Eliana led the way, jumping off the terrace into a row of shrubs. She landed hard, branches cracking beneath her, and rolled to her feet. She heard Simon and Navi land behind her, heard Navi's soft cry of pain. Partygoers leapt back, alarmed. Someone screamed. Eliana whirled, searching. A squadron of Adatrochs burst out of the morning ballroom, swords in hand. Two held rifles. They crouched on the steps, aimed, prepared to fire. Two shots rang out. Eliana ducked. A nearby stone urn shattered. A group of dancers in silks and bangles fled screaming. Eliana led Simon and Navi through the gardens, knocking past the stunned guests, trying to ignore the sounds of the pursuing Adatrochs. She could not think of Razavel, of how lucky it was that he would have no chance to tell anyone about the impossible thing he had seen. She would think only of Harkin, of her mother, of Remy.
"Remy, I'm coming. Don't be afraid."
More Adatrochs waited for them at the garden's perimeter, where a guarded tunnel led into the outer yards. Simon barreled into the Adatrochs, cut down two. Eliana saw a revolver flash and shoved Simon out of the way just as a shot rang out, then spun around and sliced open the shooter's throat. They made it into the outer yards, then through the Lord's Gate and into the city itself. The old quarter was in a panic, citizens scrambling to return to their homes. Limp naming day garlands scattered the uneven cobbled streets. Fireworks exploded overhead in a shower of red. Eliana looked back to see the palace looming some distance away, and a dozen Adatrochs in close pursuit. Finally, they emerged from the old quarter and barreled through the bedlam of the common markets on the city's edge, where vendors and shoppers, having planned for a night of revelry, now scrambled for safety. Eliana looked ahead to the East Bridge. Signal fires flared to life in the towers flanking the water. Soon every soldier in the city would know exactly where they were. They hurried past the towering Admiral's statue, where Harkin stood waiting. He lit a bombardier and hurled it past them toward the approaching Adatrox. An explosion, screams of shock and pain, then a ringing silence. The market grounds lay in ruins. The bombardier had bought them a moment or two. A small weight slammed into Eliana, throwing its arms around her. Remy. She kissed the top of his head. It's all right. I've got you. I'm here. Harkon stood behind him, looking past Eliana. More Adatrox were coming, pouring down from the city's upper levels. He threw back his hood, loaded the revolver Simon had given him.
El, take him and go, he told her.
Eliana stared at him, Remy in hand.
You're coming with us?
Simon can't spare more grenades. I can hold them off.
Are you mad? You can't shoot worth a damn.
She grabbed Harkin's arm.
And there are too many of them. They'll kill you.
Simon yanked Remy from her grip, roared,
Eliana, now!
And hurried across the bridge, sheltering Na'vi and Remy against his body. The two halves of the bridge, lowered to bring in supplies for the fate, had begun to raise. Remy looked back frantically for Eliana, but arrow fire from the city's inner wall rained down upon them, and soon he was lost to the night. Eliana grabbed Harkin's hand.
Come on!
But he stood firm, pulled her into his body for a clumsy, hard kiss.
I've always loved you,
he whispered against her mouth.
You tell me this now!
She wanted to smack him. A sob burst out as shaky laughter.
You idiot!
A nearby explosion nearly threw them off their feet. The Adatrox had detonated one of their own bombardiers. Behind Eliana, the bridge shifted and groaned.
I can handle this! Harkon shoved her toward the bridge. Go!
She stared at him for a helpless, frozen moment, drinking up the sight of him, the dark fall of his hair, the beautiful square line of his jaw. Her throat filled up with all the things she had never said, and all the things she had. None of it was enough. She turned and fled across the bridge, not looking back even as she heard Harkon open fire. He cried out, and her chest seized around her heart. She ran blindly across the shaking bridge, jumped across the gap at the top, and stumbled down the other side. She joined Simon as he fought through the tower guards, Na'vi and Remy close behind them. With each step she took, each swipe of her blades, grief struck her. Tears and smoke left her half blind. First her mother, now Harkon. Her best friend, her light on dark days. She had left him. She had left him. She listened for his gunfire and heard only chaos. The Adatrox archers on the city wall shouted commands to one another. Simon hissed at her to move faster. He grabbed a bombardier from a fallen Adatrox, triggered it, threw it back at the guard tower. The explosion threw them off their feet. Eliana's chin hit the ground. A shock of pain jolted her skull. But they had destroyed the tower, collapsed the bridge. It would give them a few minutes. She pushed herself up. Past the bridge, they hurried into one of the scattershot encampments that had formed outside the city. Refugees fleeing the dangerous countryside, hoping for a chance to get in the city. The camps were pandemonium. People bolted away from the city walls, trampling the slow and sick. Bleating animals ran crazed from their pens. Still holding Remy close by the arm, Simon tossed Na'vi his Adatrox cloak. She caught it and drew the hood up over her face. Two soldiers in threadbare cloaks found them with a pair of saddled horses. Others raced past them toward the city wall. Red Crown rebels, Eliana assumed, all ready to die to protect them.
Good, she thought. Their deaths will buy us time.
Take the boy,
Simon ordered. Na'vi nodded, her face hidden. One of the rebels gave her a leg up, and then helped Remy before running toward the wall with the others. The last rebel turned to face Simon, her battered face lit with some inner fire. She put a fist to her heart, and then to the air. The Red Crown salute. "The Empire will burn," she said. Simon inclined his head.
"May the Queen's light guide you."
Then the woman was gone.
"Wrap your arms around my waist," Na'vi murmured to Remy, "and hold on tight. What's your name?"
"Remy,"
he answered, glancing fearfully over at Eliana.
"Where are we going?"
"No,"
Eliana emerged from her numb shock, backed away from Simon.
"I ride with Remy."
"Sorry," Simon replied. "Can't have you tearing off into the countryside before you fulfill your end of our bargain."
Only days before, she had been the dread queen of her own bloody world. Unstoppable and unchallenged. Now, she was in danger of losing everyone she loved, and she could do nothing to stop it. Nothing but leave the only home she had ever known, and trust her brother's life to a stranger who would not answer her questions. Her unraveling patience snapped. She accepted Simon's outstretched hand, climbed up behind him, and brought Arabeth to his throat.
"Tell me where we're going, Wolf. And why?"
Eliana murmured.
"Or this ends. Right now."
Na'vi urged her horse slowly toward them.
"My friend," she said to Eliana, "I swear to you, he is not our enemy."
"Nirvana is a princess of Astavar," Simon answered. "And we are taking her home."
"The Empire's invasion is coming much sooner than we had thought, and in greater numbers."
Na'vi looked out from her hood, her gaze grave and earnest.
"I must warn my people in time, or Astavar will fall. This is not information we can trust to the underground."
Eliana stared at the girl. It was impossible. A princess posing as one of his lordship's concubines.
An invasion. Astavar will fall.
And if it did, so would the world's last free kingdom. The undying empire would rule all.
"Will you please lower your damned dagger?" Simon snapped. "We're wasting time."
Eliana did, and Simon threw her a murderous glare over his shoulder before adding,
"Try not to fall off."
As they fled through the eastern hills, leaving the city of Orlean behind them, they passed the crest of land where the statue of Ordric, the Lightbringer, had once stood. Now there was only bare land, scorched and grey from war. Still, as they passed the spot, Eliana felt the old pang in her heart for the dead king, and thought a prayer she had not allowed herself to say in years.
"May the Queen's light guide us home."
Chapter 13. Riel.
From sky to sky, from sea to sea, steady do I stand, and never will I flee.
The Earthright, as first uttered by Saint Tokazi, the Steadfast, patron saint of Mazabat and Earthshakers. The mountain was falling down around her. Riel hoped it was a dream. Maybe the last few days entirely had been a nightmare, and now she would wake up, and everything would be as it once was.
"Open your eyes, Riel."
Yes, she knew she needed to open her eyes, to move, to run. But the dumwort coursing through her veins made movement feel impossible. They'd drugged her. The damned Archon had decided on it, so that when she awoke at the sight of her trial, she wouldn't know where she was or how she'd gotten there. As though throwing her into these trials the day after her testimony with no time to train with her father or study with Tal, wasn't enough of a punishment for her many lies. Indeed, it was not, according to the Archon.
"Perhaps Lady Dardenne,"
he had told her blandly, his watery dark eyes fixed unblinkingly on her face.
"If you had chosen to reveal yourself immediately, following your mother's murder all those years ago, things would be different now."
"And as a 5-year-old child," she had snapped, unable to keep quiet, "such a choice had been solely my responsibility, I suppose." The Archon had folded his hands in his lap, 7 rings glittering on his soft white hands.
"Even children," he had said, "no, it is wrong to kill."
"Open your eyes, Riel." Her brain was screaming at her. Or perhaps someone else was nearby. Maybe one of the council members overseeing the trial. Maybe Tal. Maybe that strange voice had returned.
"Open your eyes."
She forced herself upright, her limbs clumsy and leaden. Her vision rocked violently back and forth. She placed a gloved hand on either side of her throbbing head. Then she sensed the heavy press of something rising high above her, cold and unrelenting. Stone. "Be prepared to move as soon as you awaken," Tal's instructions from earlier that morning drifted through her mind like sticky fragments of a dream. "They won't give you time to recover." He had refused to look her in the eye, and she had refused to beg him for it. A rumbling from behind and above snapped her head around. Like a series of gut punches, her senses crashed back into place. The clean bite of ice. The air thin and freezing. Her fingers mostly numb. Cold seeped in through her leather boots and the thickest trousers she owned, neither of which were warm enough for such an environment. But the Archon had decided she had given up the right to proper clothing, that she could only use whatever she already had in her closet, and she would not be allowed any other aid. And so, 12 hours later, here she was, thrown out into the mountain. It was falling down around her, not one of the little mountains from the chase route, but one of the monstrous peaks that formed an angry, snowy spine heading east from the capital. "Move, Riel!" She stepped back, looked up, stumbled over chunks of ice, caught herself on a snow-crusted boulder. As she watched, sheets of stone slid off the nearest peak, crashing into the snow piled on their slopes and sending up glittering sprays of ice. Suddenly she was back on the chase course, watching the mountain pass crumble and not caring, because how was she supposed to care about falling mountains with Audric in danger? But Audric was not here. Riel was alone. 12 tiny lights glinted high above, surrounding her. Her sluggish mind caught up with her rapidly awakening body. No, she was not alone. Those lights belonged to elementals, Grand Magister Florimond and her Earthshaker acolytes from the Holdfast. 12 of them formed a perimeter, castings in hand, ordered by the Archon to bring down the mountain and flatten her. This was the Earth Trial, the first of 7 that would decide her fate. They'd rushed things, angry with her, possibly afraid of her. This was sloppy and uncharacteristic of the Church, done without witnesses, pomp or ceremony. But that hardly mattered. If she didn't run, she'd be crushed.
"Riel, run!"
Down the mountain she bolted, darting past trees, leaping over veins of frigid rock. She jumped over a fallen tree half buried in snow and dropped into a drift 3 feet deep, lost her balance, lurched forward, sank into the snow, and inhaled it, coughing. She fumbled for a grip on the ice, pushed herself to her feet, looked back over her shoulder. The wide snow sea was now a churning wave, cresting hundreds of feet high, devouring everything in its path. Black pines snapped in two, fleeing foxes and deer disappeared, sucked beneath the furious white rush. Great slabs of rock rode the wave, tossed and tumbling. Terror shot through Riel's body, drowning out everything else she knew. She looked ahead once more. The pass sloped slightly upward before her. If she could make it to higher ground, she could perhaps escape the avalanche's path.
"Or," said the voice, abruptly returning, "you could."
But Riel couldn't hear the rest over the roar of the thundering mountain. Pine branches and fistfuls of ice rained down upon her. Her lungs burned, each frigid breath searing her throat as she fought her way through the snow. She clawed against trees to propel herself forward and scraped her gloved fingers raw. There, a slight rise of rock, dotted with stumps of trees, whose spindly roots cascaded down the rocks like snakes slithering for their holes. Riel leapt for the rise of rock and missed. No, she didn't miss. The earth was opening, her path falling away beneath her feet. She reached out blindly, desperate for a handhold, caught a lip of frozen rock with one hand, crashed into the rock front first, hung there, dizzy, gasping for breath. A light winked at the corner of her left eye. The earthshakers weren't going to let her escape so easily. Her feet dangling over the widening chasm, she flung up her other hand, grabbing for a better hold. She tried to pull herself up, every muscle straining. When she made it home, she would have to ask her father for help strengthening her body, if she made it home. Would this be it, then? Would she die in this first trial, hastily slapped together as if it were nothing of importance? As if her life and the fates of Tal and her father meant nothing? No, she damn well would not. "That," said the voice, "is what I like to hear." With a ragged scream, Riel pulled herself up, her body burning in protest. She wondered if her arms would snap off, then scraped her knees against rock and scrambled to the top of the rise. She ran to the left, her breath punching in and out of her lungs in ice-cold fists. Stone rose ahead of her in pillared clusters, ribboned with snow and mud. The path was solid. Hope swelled in her chest. Then, with a great echoing groan, like the plates of the earth had been shoved out of alignment, the path before her cracked open. Tiny chasms snaked across the ground, widening like the swarming mouths of subterranean creatures eager for a kill. Riel's stomach plunged to her toes. But there was no time to waste. She closed her eyes and jumped. Her feet slammed to ground. She opened her eyes, still alive, still breathing. She jumped and jumped again across the shifting patches of rock. The chasms widened, the ground quaked and jerked, trying to buck her off. A violent shudder threw her to the side. She fell, scraping her arm and knees raw, pushed herself up, and ran. The air churned with shards of ice and rock. The avalanche blocked out the sun and sucked the air from the sky. The world above her was white and roaring. The world beneath her was coming apart like it must have done when God first breathed life into the universe. "I will not die here," she thought. She pushed herself faster, her entire body on fire. Past the trees ahead, there had to be a path to safety. Ground too high for the avalanche to touch. If she could just make it a bit farther. Then she saw the truth. Beyond the trees, there was no path. It was a sheer drop, a canyon, and no way across. Her mind screamed that this was the end. Her body decided to disagree. "No," she whispered. "No," agreed the voice. "Not today. Not ever." Riel whirled around to face the roaring white snow sea, planted her frozen legs on the cliff's edge. She thrust her hands into the air and squeezed her eyes shut. Didn't think anything. Didn't even think
stop. She threw up her hands, the solid heat inside her screaming, no, more loudly than any voice or word ever could. A narrow wall of rock, wide enough to shelter her, burst out of the ground before her and shot up into the air mere seconds before the avalanche slammed into it. Riel stood, head bowed and eyes closed, her hands pressed flat against the fast-rising rock, palms sparking against the stone like flint. The avalanche broke with a roaring howl on either side of her. The churning snow and rock scraped against her arms and feet, threatened to lift her up off the ground and fling her into the canyon. "Hold fast to the rock," said Riel's blood. "Hold fast." And the narrow slab of rock seemed to listen. It stood tall, shaking against the force of the crashing avalanche. The air tasted sour, damp tendrils of mud-scented earthshaker magic straining to their limit as they whipped through the air. A tiny flame of triumph unfurled between Riel's burning lungs. They had tried to kill her, and they had failed. They had crashed a mountain down atop her, and she had lived. She stood trembling on the cliff's edge, the same mountain that had tried to kill her now shielding her from itself. "Please stop," she whispered to the mountain. She didn't blame it for being angry at such abuse. She pressed her cheek against the hot wall of stone, which now stood rigid like an ancient thing that had always existed on that spot, a queer pillar of rock, lonely and stubborn. The tips of her fingers were aflame. If she kept this going much longer, her chest would crack open, her heart would burst, her lungs would give out. "Please," she whispered, each word an effort. "Stop." Exhausted tears leaked down her cheeks. Then, whether it was a response to her plea or simply the moment Grand Magister Florimond decided enough was enough, the mountain eased itself back whole. The avalanche subsided. Boulders dropped abruptly from the sky. It was chaos to stillness in the span of 5 seconds. A bird called out forlornly. Riel let herself fall, slumping at the foot of her rock. The snow was a cool pillow under her flaming cheek. "Only 6 more, she whispered, a watery smile playing at her lips. And then pain hit her all at once. "I'll be here when you wake," said the voice. And some dim, spinning part of her tired mind whispered back, "Thank you." Chapter 14. Eliana. Since our war with the humans began, I have had only one dream. Every night, the fog surrounding it lifts, and I understand more of what I see. A woman, made of gold, brighter than the sun. She stands in a river of blood, and light falls from the ends of her hair. Is she friend or foe? This my dreams have not made clear to me. But I know this. She will come. In this war or the next, she will come. Lost Writings of the Angel Aryava.
"I hear you're a storyteller," said Navi. Eliana waited for Remy's response. Nothing. For 2 days, they'd been driving the horses north by night, hiding in tense silence when they heard signs of pursuing Adatrox patrols, and then, from sunup to sundown, waiting in the trees for nightfall. The moment they'd had a chance to rest, hiding in a ditch lined with reeking mud as the sun shone dangerously bright above, Remy had whispered,
"What happened to Harkon?" "He stayed behind to give us time to escape," Eliana had told him, her voice carefully careless and her heart in shreds. I left him instructions. He'll catch up with us later. Don't lie to me. He's dead, isn't he? She couldn't look at him. Harkon, come on. You know it takes more than a few Adatrox to shut up. Truly, Remy, we can't know for certain. Even as she said the words, she couldn't bring herself to believe them. He could still be alive. Please. Remy had drawn his knees to his chest and turned away from her. Just shut up. He had said nothing since. Now, however, Na'vi seemed determined to make him speak. What kind of stories do you like to tell? She asked. Eliana, on first watch, leaned against a nearby silver oak, Arabeth in one hand and Whistler in the other. She glared into the forest. Slender silver oaks with faintly gleaming bark surrounded them, as did waxy-leaved, white-flowered gemma trees. Stout watchtowers, branchless save for frazzled-looking clusters at the top, stood lopsided throughout. They were popular along Orleans' outer wall, traditionally planted to ward off invaders, which Eliana found hysterical. She'd always thought they resembled old men with soft bellies and wild hair. When she'd first told Remy that, he'd considered the tree nearest them, then put his nose in the air, bowed, and said to the tree, "Well met, good sir. Might I offer you a comb?" Eliana had laughed so hard she'd actually squeaked. Her hand tightened around Whistler. God, it'd be nice to fight something. Instead of standing here, feeling sorry for myself, and angry, mostly angry. No. She drew a long, slow breath. Mostly missing Harkon. And mother. And father. For a moment, she allowed herself to imagine Harkon there beside her, on watch with her, distrusting Simon with her, worrying about her mother with her, and her throat tightened so painfully that she lost her breath. Pay attention, Eliana. You're on watch. She glared at the trees until her eyes dried, then glanced sidelong at Simon, who had settled down to rest. He sat in the shadow of another oak, scanning the dawn-lit forest. She considered him. Grief and worry nettled her insides. This stillness was maddening. What would he do if she lunged at him with blades drawn? He'd bested her back home, but only because of his gun. If she could gut him before he could reach the holster, and then what? The whole point of this mad venture was to use him, not kill him. Eliana thumped her head against the tree at her back and glared at the sky. Talking to me might make you feel better, Na'vi insisted, her voice kind. Eliana rolled her eyes, but then Remy surprised her. I like to write stories about magic, he replied, hoarsely. Eliana's breath caught. She hadn't realized until that moment how deeply she'd missed the sound of his voice. Magic? Na'vi sounded intrigued. You mean the old world? I like writing about the elementals, especially Earthshakers. Why Earthshakers? Sometimes I wish an army of Earthshakers would come to Orleans. Crack open the ground, let it swallow the city whole. I see, said Na'vi evenly. Sorry, Remy muttered. Eliana says I shouldn't talk about things like that. It isn't kind. That seemed to amuse Na'vi. And your sister is? Bitch. Eliana flashed her the smile she usually reserved for marks she wanted to coax into bed. When I want to be, she replied. Remy threw her an irritated look. Na'vi put her arm around his shoulders. I do understand wanting to tear down your city, she said. Sometimes I think life would be easier if the oceans would rise up and drown Astavar. Then I wouldn't have to spend every moment of my life in an agony of worry for it.
Remy nodded.
Water workers could do that. Indeed they could, if there were any left. And they'd have to be quite powerful even then, to sink an entire country.
A beat of silence. Then Remy said, hushed.
Queen Riel could have done it.
Ah, Na'vi let out a little sigh. The Blood Queen herself.
Yes, I'm sure she could have plunged every mountain standing to the depths if she had lived long enough to do it. Do you ever write stories about her?
I wrote a story once about what would have happened if she hadn't died. If she'd lived forever with the angels, and the world still had magic in it. Do you think the angels would have made her one of them? That's what I wrote in my story. She led them to the sky, and they searched for God in the stars.
I think, said Na'vi slowly, that if the Blood Queen had lived, she would have become something more powerful than even the angels, with all their millennia of knowledge, could have comprehended.
Eliana pushed herself off the tree, no longer able to stand there and listen to Remy's voice grow more and more excited, as if this Princess Nirvana were some dear friend of his, as if he didn't care that Eliana waited in the shadows, ready to slit any strange throats that might happen by.
And would he rather I stand idly and watch him get torn to pieces the next time we're attacked?
She knew what he would say. Yes, the fool.
Because at least then I wouldn't be killing. Is that right, dearest brother?
Do you like writing stories?
Remy asked.
I like telling stories others have written, Na'vi answered. Stories about Astavar, most of all.
Remy hesitated. Then, shyly,
will you tell me one?
Eliana dared to look back at them. Remy had wedged himself against Na'vi's side in the bracken, their backs against a felled watchtower tree, his head tucked under hers. The girl was stroking his shaggy hair, slow and soft, and when she caught Eliana staring, the expression she wore was one of such compassion that Eliana fantasized for an immensely satisfying moment about stalking over and striking her square in the jaw. She turned away toward Simon, but he was gone. She froze. Fear carved her chest into ribbons.
I certainly will share a story with you, and I'm honored that a wordsmith like you would ask, Na'vi replied. You know, of course, that the patron saint of Astavar is Tamarin the Cunning,
Remy said, his voice lighting up.
She was a shadow caster. I read that she slept under the stars with her black leopard for a pillow.
And did you also read, Na'vi said, that shadows grew out of her scalp instead of hair?
Her favorite comb was coated in crushed black pearls and carved from the bones of a wolf who died saving her life when she was a girl.
I don't know that story,
Remy whispered, awestruck. Eliana crept away from them, their murmured voices following her into the morning air like an unfamiliar lullaby. Daggers out, she circled the tree under which Simon had been standing. Gone. She supposed he could be relieving himself somewhere, but the unease inching up her torso said otherwise. Ducking underneath a drooping oak branch, using Whistler's blade to part a curtain of hanging moss, Eliana knew she was moving too far away from camp, that she shouldn't leave Na'vi, Remy, and the horses untended. But without Simon, they were all lost. They'd get turned around in these swamp-riddled forests faster than a shift in the air, slight but undeniable. Someone was near. Eliana crouched in the shadow of a gemma tree, searching the forest. Then something cold pricked the side of her neck.
Give me a reason to kill you,
came a woman's voice, vicious, and made of gravel.
And I'll do it.
Eliana pressed her neck harder against the woman's knife, felt the blade's tip
sink into her flesh. The pain thrilled her.
I am here, it said, and I do not run from death. I seek it out.